Out of quite a lot of material, which of course could be presented even in a very limited context, and our lecture today, I'd like to concentrate on one issue, which I hope will be able to focus some of your attention to the very specific historical context out of which the only experiment at a mass proletarian Jewish movement in the 19th and 20th century grew. Now, when one would like to understand the Bund as it occurred around the turn of the century in the Tsarist Empire, which at that time included most of Poland, and as it later developed in post-1918 Poland, one has to bear in mind a number of factors regarding the development of Jewish as well as Gentile general society in Eastern Europe. And for the purpose of my presentation, I'd like to compare some aspects of the development of the Jewish community within the context of Central Europe, mainly Germany, and on the other hand, the development of the Jewish community in Eastern Europe, mainly the Polish-Russian context. I realized from a short talk I had with George Morte what you have been doing in the German and Central European context, and I'd like to bring those two things together. Now, the development of a secular Jewish community in Germany as well as Eastern Europe is in a way a part of the general modernization and secularization of general society. And the extremely interesting fact is that the nature of general society, German on one hand and Polish-Russian on the other hand, determined very much the mode in which the Jewish secular society developed and got either integrated into or disintegrated from the general society. Now, German society in the mid-19th century, now generally very much aware of a lack of political unification in Germany, and certainly the German history of the 19th century is a history of a striving for political unification. German history and German society still was living in a society whose ethnic and linguistic borders, if not politically fixed, were at least culturally fixed. The Germans, though they lacked a political unity, did have political entities which were German, like Prussia, Bavaria, Württemberg, the Habsburgian Empire, which was German and the question of an ethnic determination and a revival of a national culture and a fight against an external national oppression was never very important in the German history. What was important in German history of the 19th century was the quest for the political unification of the various existing German kingdoms, principalities, duchies, and so on. Now, this enabled in Germany the development of a bourgeois, civil, relatively liberal society, not exactly on a Anglo-Saxon individualistic model, but still within the general dream, if we may say so, of the Enlightenment. And therefore, Jewish integration into that society was by way of a secularization of the Jewish religious establishment and the integration of Jews as individuals into German society. Therefore, what you have in Jewish society is a very specific embonpoint of Jewish German society. The typical 19th century Jewish person who is integrated, who is being integrated to German society, is being integrated via the bourgeois civil society, capitalist, middle class ethos, and professional and economic backdrop. And if so many of those Jews ended in the left wing, they ended, as you know, as Heinemann, Lassalle, so many others in the later 19th century, they became socialists and they became revolutionaries out of the general middle class manage of the society. None of the German socialists, leaders of Jewish background had any proletarian background. They were mostly, if not university graduates, and certainly people coming from professional families like Lassalle, Heinemann, and so many others. Now, the process of modernization and secularization in Eastern Europe was a very different one. There, the question was not just a question of political unification of existing national unities, but the question was the emergence and re-emergence of a new national consciousness. This was the case in Poland, this was the case later in Romania, this was the case in the Western Russian border provinces, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and so on. The Jews who were living in the Pale of Settlement, in this huge chunk of territory, Eastern Poland, Western Russia, Ukraine, and so on, were a very different kettle of fish from the German Jews. First of all, there was the question of numbers. Around 1850, Jews in Germany did not number more than 200,000 out of a total population of 40 million. Now, taken together in the Russian Empire, out of about 150 million, there were, toward the end of the 19th century, about 5 million, which is a completely different order of magnitude. But even this does not give us, I think, an adequate understanding of the weird position of the Jews in Eastern European society, because those 5 to 6 million, depends if you start counting before the next invasion or after the, Jewish communities were concentrated in areas where, in some cases, the Jews made up to 60 or 70% of the population. What is very typical of the Pale of Settlement in East Europe and of some cities is the fact that while the villages were Polish, Romanian, Lithuanian, Russian, Ukrainian, White Russian, what have you, the market towns and the provincial towns had a very high proportion of Jewish of the Jewish population. In some cases, as I said, the town was 70 to 80% Jewish. In some larger towns, it was lower, but sometimes to the tune, like in places like of the Villa or Warsaw, to the tune of 30 to 50%. Now, this is an order of magnitude where a qualitative difference comes into it. It is not rare in a place like Warsaw, where 35% of the population is Jewish. The problem of the integration of this Jewish population into the general modernized society is very different from the problem posed in Berlin, where out of 500,000 population, you have 20 to 30,000. It's a completely different problem. It's not a problem of an individual making it, not passing, mind you, but making it as a Jew. But as an individual, in a society where the Jews are 0.5% or 1% of the population, where individual mobility through either economic activity or education is possible, so there would be all kinds of opposition to it in the fundamentalist views of the population and so on. Whereas, in a situation like Eastern Europe, where you do have, in mainly among the urban population, a situation where Jews make up 30 to 50%, there the question of individual assimilation, individual integration, isn't possible at all. There the question of emancipation is not one of individuals, but of the Jews as a community. It's not that the individual Jew can or cannot be integrated into society. There, in Vilno and West Litovsk and Warsaw, there the question is, are the Jews as a community going to be integrated into society? So the question becomes one which determines a very different course of Jewish and German history. In Germany, a question of individual integration, in East Europe, a question of communal, or if you wish, ethnic integration. Therefore, what appeared among the German Jews in the West was a very high degree of individual success stories and a very high degree of penetration of Jews, great individuals, into artistic creation, the creativity, into the press, and not into the civil service and the teaching profession, because they were those people who are not Jewish, and so on and so forth. Now, whereas in the East, you have the question of the creation of Jewish organizations for the creation of some kind of institution. This, by the way, also, and I just want to say one word about it, created a very different aspect to the question of conversion. Yet the question of integration is one of individual integration. Individual conversion may have been, as it may be to many German Jews, a solution to the problem of total integration. Whereas the issue of how there were cases of individual conversion, there were very few, and certainly the question of an individual conversion couldn't have been faced in the same way as that of 1 or 200,000 German Jews. I mean, it's inconceivable that if in Warsaw the 300,000 Jews would have converted, all of a sudden the Jewish problem would have disappeared. Because they lived in a community, as a community, and not as an individual. Now, on top of that, the economic status of the Jews in Eastern Europe, due to those very different demographic structures, was very different. There were areas in Germany where Jews were living, mainly in Hessen and Alsace, where Jews were living in the countryside as peddlers, middlemen, and so on. Mostly, they were living here as individual people of commerce in the cities, and they were of a middle-class background. In Eastern Europe, a transformation in the economic transformation of the 19th century created for the first time a massive Jewish proletariat. And in order to understand the creation of this massive Jewish proletariat, one word about the economic goal of the Jews in Eastern Europe. Now, early 19th century Eastern European society was still a predominantly agricultural society, with, I wouldn't say really feudal, but certainly quasi-feudal characteristics. It is within this quasi-feudal agricultural society where Jews were the economic middlemen. Not only the small peddler, the sometimes tax collectors for the local noblemen, the having the concession of producing and marketing spirits and so on. But they were mainly in the position of being the link between the peasantry and the sometimes absentee landholding population. This, as you can imagine, created a tremendous stress on the position of the Jew vis-a-vis the lower class. Because in Eastern Europe, what this very immediate position of the Jew as a middleman between the peasantry and the upper classes created was a lower class anti-Semitism, which had its social roots. Now, I'm not going to go into roots of anti-Semitism now, But I just want to add one thing. That to the general Christian anti-Jewish stereotypes and anti-Jewish feelings, which were the same in Germany probably as they were in Eastern Europe. In the Eastern European situation, the enmity and the antagonism between the lower class Gentiles and the Jews had a specific economic aspect. To the Ukrainian and Ukrainian peasant, the Jew was the local oppressor. Now this poor Jew might have been himself oppressed by the situation in which he was sort of hemmed in between a peasantry and an aristocracy without being able to move out of the way. But to the immediate peasant, who never met Pan Tadeusz, if I may use the Polish simile, who never met the local Polish landlord who was sitting in Warsaw, St. Petersburg or Moscow, he did meet the Jewish tax collector. Something which those of you who are aware of black anti-Semitism in this country would recognize as a problem which has, if you wish, some tragic dimensions because of the element of repetition. Now this extremely important lower class social and economic anti-Semitism was of course grafted on the normal specialities, which is the Greek Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church in Poland, were far stronger than they were among some of the more enlightened Protestant churches in Germany. But the problem was there. Now, in the early 19th century, this traditional agricultural structure of the East European village underwent tremendous transformation. I don't want to go into that. What happened in Eastern Europe in the 19th century is the same that happened in France and England and later in Germany in the 17th and 18th century. There was a transformation of the village and a modernization of agricultural practices as well as of land economy. In Russia in the 1860s, with the liberation of the serfs, independent peasant community, not anymore dependent as a serf on the landlord, emerged. And as a consequence of that, the traditional middleman position of the Jew, invidious and insecure as it was really eliminated. And between 1840 and 1880, you had a mass migration of hundreds of thousands of Jews from the hinterland, from the small market towns, from the villages, and so on, into the provincial capitals, like Kiev, Kharkov, Moscow, Odessa, and so on, into which they were Warsaw, into which they were allowed to migrate, because into the great metropolis of Russia, St. Petersburg and Moscow, Jews were not allowed to move. So you had, again, a process of urbanization under pressure, a process of a disruption of the traditional Jewish way of life in the village, and you had the creation in the city of a typical situation of urbanization and the beginning of a capitalist system, with the Jews being the most important element of the proletariat. In cities like Vilna and Warsaw, where at Lodz, and other places not as well known as Lodz, where you had the beginning of a textile industry that sometimes was owned by Jewish textile merchants that went into production and so on, but not always. Most of the workers came from, most of the workers were Jewish, because in the Polish and Ukrainian and Russian village, the emancipation of the slaves did not create a tremendous pressure towards urbanization, but towards settling on the land, finally on the peasantry. So the general process of urbanization in Eastern Europe in the 19th century was one, I don't want to go into the statistics, where the percentage of Jewish being urbanized and proletarianized was far higher than the percentage of non-Jews, Russians, Poles, and so on, that were urbanized, because the Jews were the first to be squeezed out of the traditional village society. And here you had the massive situation of the emergence of the Jewish proletariat under very unusual conditions, conditions that were not to be repeated anywhere after World War I. Now, to this has to be added the natural aspect from which I already started. If you look at the standards at which the Bund as a socialist, Marxist, but Jewish national workers' organization started, you find some two very important factors. First of all, you find that the creation of the Bund, of a Jewish socialist or social democratic revolutionary workers' party, antedates the creation of a general Russian socialist party. There was a Jewish socialist party in Russia 2 years before the first conference of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party. Precisely because the number of Jews and the articulation of the socialist consciousness among the Jews, because of the demographic factor I was trying point out, was so very strong. Secondly, if you look at the geographical distribution of the places where the Jewish workers started organizing Jewish working class groups that ultimately ended up with the creation of the general body of the Bund, you'll find that it is specifically in places where a number of cultures were clashing that the Jews became more aware of their specific ethnic nation. The typical city, of course, is Vilna. Vilna is a city which for centuries was a bone of contention between the Poles and the Lithuanians. At that time it was part of the Russian Empire. The population of Vilna at the end of the 19th century was about 20% Polish and 20% Lithuanian and 40% Jewish and the rest German and Russian. The York administration was Russian. It's still here, you've got the city about which the Poles and the Lithuanians fall, and the largest ethnic group is Jewish. Something which, of course, didn't make the Jews very much loved by either the Lithuanians and all the Poles. Especially as Vilna had historical significance both for the Polish kingdom and for Lithuanian nation. It was in this city where three or four cultures clashed that the specific nature of the Jewish working class became far more important. Because if you go into cities like Odessa or cities like Kharkov or Kiev, where there was a Jewish working class population, but the ethnic population, the non-Jewish population, was more or less homogeneous, it wasn't that much which between, say, a Russian or Ukrainian majority and a Jewish minority as there would be in a city that is fairly ethnically conscious and divided between Poles and Lithuanians and the Jews somewhere thick in the middle. Something different on a different level, by the way, happened in another multi-ethnic city that became very important in Jewish history, but not on a proletarian, but on a middle class level. This is Prague, where again the Jews were in the middle between a German culture and a Czech culture, and this flowering of Jewish culture and Jewish writers and so on in Prague that gave you people like Kafka and Franz Werfel and later in a way Martin Buber, Hugo Bergmann and others, is also as a consequence of this clash of different cultures. Now, one of the reasons for the establishment of a separate Jewish working class organization were two reasons. First of all, the higher degree of articulation about the class position among the Jewish workers compared to those of the Lithuanian or Polish workers.
The class consciousness of the Jewish workers was far more developed, say, around 1901 than it compared with that of the non-Jewish workers. The reason for that is very simple. The non-Jewish workers were usually peasants removed half a generation from the peasant origin. The degree of literacy was almost non-existent. As you have in so many early industrialized societies, the link of this proletariat with its peasant background, its affiliation with the church and with conservative elements is very strong. It takes some time until you really transform peasants into a semi or fully conscious working class. Now, in the case of the Jewish members of this new Jewish proletariat, they were also removed half a generation from a country background, but not from a peasant background, and the degree of literacy was far higher than that of Lithuanian and Polish peasants. For this reason, their ability to grasp some of the slogans of socialism, to read the literature, to be sort of uplifted by the kind of literature and promise of socialism, communism, and the degree of vision of the emancipation of men was far more heightened than that of the Polish, Lithuanian, and Russian working class people. If you go, this is a sort of a very quantitative analysis, and it's in a way boring, but if you look around between 1905, the first Russian Revolution, at the numbers of socialist pamphlets published in Yiddish and all in local languages but for Jewish consumption, and the number of pamphlets published in Polish, Romanian, and Russian, you find that the number of Jewish pamphlets, books, translations, and so on far outstrips those of the various non-Jewish population. Now, a second element for the emergence of separate Jewish organizations beyond that of the objective factor of a higher degree of literacy, education, and ergo class consciousness was the fact that the non-Jewish working class population, being peasants one generation removed from the peasant origin, were among the most stronger anti-Semitic groups in Eastern European society. If you go into Eastern European society around the turn of the last century, you will find that among the middle classes, the Gentile middle classes, and the aristocracy, something of the universalistic views of the Enlightenment give rise to a more benevolent, if not outright philosemitic, attitude towards the Jews. That's something in which the peasantry did not partake. And the peasantry, and we have quite a number of mainly Russian pamphlets on that, the peasant who in his village identified the Jew as the immediate oppressor, bloodsucker, tax collector, spirit monopolist, and so on, coming into the city, becoming a proletarian, what does he find? Same Jew as a competitor for jobs. Same Jew as a competitor, and sometimes a more enterprising one, because of some kind of commercial activity and background and a high degree of literacy, for the scarcity of a very tough early industrial, for the benefits, scarce benefits of a very tough early industrial system. So the traditional social, and I'm abstracting for the moment from the Christian anti-Jewish element, but the traditional social anti-Semitism of the Eastern European lower classes became very early translated into a working class anti-Semitism, which caused many working class organizations, non-Jewish working class organizations, not willing to accept Jews as members in the trade unions, clandestine organizations, and so on. So the emergence of a Jewish separate working class organization in the form of the Bund was really a was a point of meeting between the inability of Jews to be accepted into general organizations and the very strong feeling of community among Jews in this society. Now, this again brings out one of the differences of position of the modernized, secularized Jew in Eastern Europe as compared to Germany. Take a German Jew, even one from the Orthodox Frankfurt ghetto around 1820. He speaks a dialect, a Jewish dialect, which is very akin to Eastern European Yiddish, or Sylvan. Now, suppose this fellow, who is Orthodox, becomes sort of secularized. He dons a Western dress. He trains himself to speak the correct German rather than the Yiddish jargon. He is trying, though he doesn't have to convert, or he doesn't convert in this particular case, he is minimizing, and he can very easily minimize his contact with Jewish people. If he's making it economically, he will be moving into another section of town. He will try to give his children some kind of Jewish education, not really a counterpart of Sunday school, but something very much like that. He will go to the synagogue, as you would call it, on the high holidays, but besides that, he could live a life again, very much like the Gentile neighbor. And in his own eyes, at least, he would have thought that he has really made it on par with the Gentile neighbor. Never mind what the Gentile neighbor thinks about that. Now, that's something which isn't really open to the Jewish person in the highly ethnically conscious Eastern European place. You see, the German Jew always was a German Jew. He was speaking a kind of German. Nobody ever thought that he was anything but, might have been a Jew or a bloody Jew, but certainly he was German. There was no doubt about that. When it comes to the question of the Jew in Vilna, now, he speaks Yiddish, he doesn't know Polish, his jargon is not a jargon of Polish or a jargon of Lithuanian, it's a jargon of German. So he speaks Yiddish. The Poles don't consider him Polish. And if he is going to start learning Polish, as so many of them did, the alien element there would be very strong. If he starts learning Lithuanian, this would again create a problem because he's a Jew living in Lithuania, but he certainly is considered Lithuanian the same way as a German Jew was considered German Islam. So what happens among the Jews in the Eastern European place is that insofar as a Jew assimilate with a non-Jewish culture, they assimilate with an elite culture and not with a local one. Either with German culture, which is Kultur for all of East Europe, because this is precisely what the Germans were for the Russians, for example, or he assimilates with Russian culture, which is, of course, the culture of the elite. So the Jew in Vilno, who lives among Poles and among Lithuanians, or the Jew in Kharkov, who lives among Lithuanians, White Russians, that is, and Lithuanians, and if he becomes integrated and assimilated and sort of secularized, the kind of culture he will adopt will be usually the German or the Russian, which makes the developed, assimilated Jew even more alien than he was before, as far as the local population was concerned. And frankly speaking, I mean, if you shed your ethnic Jewish provincial background, why become Lithuanian? The Lithuanians were trying at that time to assimilate to some kind of culture beyond their own very limited peasant background. It's different with the Poles, but the Poles again on one hand, were extremely nationalistic, and Polish nationalism was very based on Catholicism, which again excluded the Jew. But the point is that which way you were moving, your Yiddish language, your background, you living in a community which comprises 30 or 40% of the German community, creates a very different aspect. A very different aspect than that of the Western, especially the German Jew, to whom the question of
which culture to assimilate into or integrate with very is clear. There is no problem. And to which the individual way is open, which is close to the highly concentrated Jewish ethnic communities living in an area of clashing nationality. Now, one of the problems of the book, and this is the last remark, set of remarks I'd like to make, one, that when a general organization of a working class nation in Russia was established, the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, the Bund became affiliated with it. But it is here that its problems really start. Because what the Bund, as by the way, is the strongest group among the groups that set up the Russian Social Democratic Party, wanted was an autonomy. It said that the problems of the Jewish working class are to a certain degree different from that of the other. It said propaganda, literature, education to the Jewish working class will have to be conducted in Yiddish, and there is no reason why one should impose on the Jews the Russian language any more than the Lithuanian or the Polish. The Jewish proletariat has a language which is, by the way, this is where it all started, as a beer language. There was a very strong feeling among working class Jews that Yiddish is, by being a jargon and being looked down by the intelligentsia, you know, nice German speaking Jews don't speak with those foul accents of Yiddish. So this class element in the usage of Yiddish became a very close symbol for class identification. So why not accept this language, which is a living and plebeian language, as one of the languages in which propaganda, education, what have you, would have to be done? The Russian Social Democratic Party, especially under the influence of Lenin, but also of others, found here a very difficult nut to crack. Because on one hand, Lenin had a long controversy with the book in the first decade of the century. On one hand, Lenin, as all the other non-Jewish leaders of the Russian Social Democratic Party, they're very much aware of the revolutionary potential and centrality of the Jewish working class. That at that time comprised something like 20-30% of the organized working class in Russia. And certainly one of the elements of progress, as I mentioned earlier, more conscious and articulate than others. On the other hand, the question of a separate Jewish organization within the universal working class movement in Russia created tremendous problems vis-a-vis other nationalities, vis-a-vis the ingrained anti-Semitism of so many of the peasant proletarians of the non-Jewish organizations. And now it has to be said very openly that Lenin and other leaders of the Russian Social Democratic Party tried to do their best to combat this working class anti-Semitism using Bebel's famous pamphlet and, you know, his famous saying that anti-Semitism is a socialism of the food and swamp. I mean, Lenin is 100% okay on the question of anti-Semitism, but on the other hand, didn't want to stick his neck out.
he was going to, you know, he wasn't going to ask for trouble by having, as it could have very easily happened, having the Russian Social Democratic Party dominated, not by people who were individually Jewish, didn't care about that at all, but about people who were organized in a separate Jewish organization. And it was at that moment that many of the leaders of the group, one of them being Marco, who later became one of the leaders of the Mensheviks, left the group and left a specific affiliation with the group in order to become non-differentiated members of the great Russian Social Democratic Party. And it was at that moment that many, if you look at so many of the Russian revolutionaries that were of Jewish background, many of them really started as Bundists. Some remained later when the rupture between the Russian Social Democratic Party and the Bund occurred. Some remained in the Bund, but many, and some of the more articulated and more important ones, like Marco, Dan, and others, left the Bund and became members, individual members of the German Party. By the way, the number of Jews in the various factions of the Russian Social Democratic Party is also very interesting. I mean, there is around 1917, of course, is a very strong impression that so many of the leaders of the Bolshevik Party were Jewish, and this is of course true, especially when in the Civil War the Soviet and the Bolsheviks became really the only force that was trying to save the Jews from the focus of the Ukraine and the right-wing White Army. But in terms of the elite of the party, the number of Jews in the Menshevik Party, the percentage of Jews in the leadership of the Menshevik Party, was far higher than the number of Jews in the leadership of the Bolshevik Party. One of the possible reasons for this again is that some of the Jacobin elitist elements that were very strong in Lenin go back to Russian social revolutionary late 1890s populist Narodnik idea. And the Narodnik idea is something where in the Narodnik movement you hardly find any Jews, because the Narodnik movement, after all, is based on the peasantry and so on. You have some crazy Jews there, but usually when you don't find many Jews trying to go to the people being the Russian people, and so on, who, if they knew something about the Jews, probably wasn't very many. At that moment, very, very complimentary. So you have a far more Jewish element in the Menshevik Party, that is more traditionally social democratic, orthodox, Marxist, the Panovist, Kautsky, and so on, is far more stronger than in the Bolshevik Party. Now, I think it is here that one has to start with the history of the movement, and that's what I'm not going to do. What I try to do is to give some of the aspects of what I consider to be a very unique and interesting phenomenon. There is, of course, another aspect in this game, that it is the emergence of the movement as a separate Jewish working class organization that gave rise ideologically and organizationally to the emergence of a Zionist labor movement, socialist movement in Eastern Europe. Because so many of the Zionist labor movements in Eastern Europe, the socialist Zionists like Koalition, Segregation, Apoelatzen, and others that started in Russia around 1905, really started their way as socialists in the Bund. And when they got rejected by the general working class movement, moved to a more explicit national position transcending the Bund. So what ultimately happened to the Bund in terms of leadership was perhaps very indicative of the tragedy of this attempt to create, without a territorial basis, a specific Jewish national proletarian party. When ultimately the Russian General Party did not accept the Bund as an autonomous group, what happened was
that a part of the membrane rejects the specific Jewish affiliation and enters the general stream of the Russian Social Democratic Movement, did mention it, or Bolshevik. And another group rejected then the halfway out or the half measure of the Bund and started a conscious Palestine-oriented Jewish socialist working class movement. And the Bund was left out with a very large membership because of the huge numbers of Jewish volunteers. But in a way, the Bund was left in the middle with the leadership in the elite and the intellectual leadership splitting off into, on the one hand, the direction of the general labor movement and, of course, the 1917 revolution, and the other one, that of Zionist socialism. Now, if there are any questions, I think we have 5 minutes for that. Okay. No problem about the book. Thank you very much.